Yesterday afternoon, a consultant hired by the state of Missouri unveiled a dramatic proposal to remake Kansas City public schools. According to the new concept, all of the district schools will be operated by nonprofits and overseen by a small state-run office. The idea is that no urban school district in the country has succeeded in educating low-income kids, but that particular schools with a lot of autonomy have been successful. This is Central Standard. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. On today's show, we hear from the head of the education consulting group, C-Trust, as to why he thinks this plan will finally turn around KC's schools and why it's better than the incremental gains the district has been making. Plus, a look at the role of handwriting in a 21st century elementary school. That's coming up on Central Standard just after this news. Welcome to Central Standard. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. The specter of a state takeover has hung over Kansas City schools for more than a decade. Decades, really. But although the state was given authority to do so last year, Missouri Education Commissioner Chris Nicastro said she wanted to take a step back and research the best way to reform low-performing districts. After all, a state takeover in St. Louis back in 2007 still hasn't resulted in that district regaining accreditation. So this summer, the State Board of Education hired educational consultant C-Trust to study the unaccredited Kansas City School District, as well as best practices from around the country. They made their recommendations for Kansas City Public Schools to the State Board yesterday. And today, the director of C-Trust joins us here on Central Standard to talk about his ideas. Ethan Gray is executive director at Cities for Educational Entrepreneurship Trust, or E-Trust. We're also taking your calls at 816-235-2888. 88, that's 816-235-2888. Now, back in June, you told the magazine Education Week that you thought KC was one of three cities that's ripe for big change. Why Kansas City?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me, Sylvia. It's an honor to be here, and it's a real privilege for us to be able to come and talk about ideas for improving public education in Kansas City. The reason why we suggested that Kansas City was one of the communities that's ripe for education change is, first of all, it's direly needed. When you're in a situation where 70% of children in the city are below proficiency, where it's so infrequent that students are really prepared for college, where the average ACT score is 16.1, which is very significantly below the national average and even the state average, it's clear that academically there's a student crisis. The reason why we were optimistic for the prospects for change in Kansas City, though, are because of the state's accountability system, where the state not only has the authority but has the obligation to intervene in systems that are struggling to achieve results for their students. So we saw this as an opportunity to have a conversation about how to help a system in urban America really improve results for kids.
And I can't overlook that there has been a controversy over the hiring of your group. The state education commissioner was working with you and according to emails, appeared to really want to work with your organization. Now, those are questions for the state. But I'm curious, when you got to Kansas City, what most surprised you when you started digging deep into what's actually going on here?
I think I don't know that I'd say it's a surprise. Unfortunately, we see this in many urban settings across America. But the degree to which student performance levels have been really troublingly low for so long, I think, is a real issue. And in some respects, I think it's created a sense of low expectations among some groups. I think we've heard an unfortunate number of times how frequently students in urban America can't achieve at high levels. And we know from the research that that's just not true, that there are schools serving populations of students that have grown up in disadvantaged circumstances that are achieving at breathtaking levels, where essentially – and we profile several of those schools in our report – where every student is achieving at high levels, where every student is accessing college or post-secondary opportunities. And so our view is every student in Kansas City deserves a school like that, and how can we create a system or help create a system that would foster the conditions through which those schools could emerge.
And your plan starts with the idea that no actual school district in the country has done that, has been successful educating low-income kids, although individual schools have been. What are these individual schools doing?
Well, that's really the heart of the research question that we asked. We wanted to look into the question, what are the conditions that have enabled these great urban schools to thrive when others have struggled? And so we really dug into that question, and we researched the literature, and we evaluated the schools that are achieving at incredible levels for students across America. And we identified two core conditions that we think are the core enabling conditions. They don't guarantee greatness, but they are the enabling conditions that enable greatness in schools. And those two core conditions are, number one, educators run schools. When educators have power to make the core decisions about what happens at the school level, great things can happen. We think educators need to have more power over what's happening in schools. They need to be able to choose their colleagues, what's happening at in staffing, their curriculum. They need to be able to set the kind of school culture and school programming that they think will best meet the needs of the child and the children in the school. And so the very top issue for us is ensuring that educators have much more control over what happens at the school level. The second condition, though, is that in return, those schools need to be held meaningfully accountable for achieving great results. That's a perfect marriage. So the system, in our view, should be focused on accountability, on ensuring that there are common goals that schools can achieve, but then getting out of the way and allowing schools to achieve them in however they see fit.
And what is, I mean, how do you measure when a school is really achieving? They are succeeding at educating kids. What does that look like to you?
Well, there's state and federal guidance on that. And so at a sort of very basic level, you've got questions as to whether kids are literate, whether they are able to perform proficiently in math and language, arts and science, et cetera. And then there are other metrics like their ability to access college, to succeed in post-secondary opportunities. I think that we could have a whole nother conversation about what the ideal accountability system is for schools. And one of the themes that we heard in some of our focus groups with teachers was that they didn't like the current system's focus on test-based accountability without having access to the kind of rich data that would help them change their instructional models over time. So I think there's room for more debate as to how to design that accountability system. But for our purposes, we had to work within the Missouri guidelines with the current accountability system there. So we're focusing mostly on measurable things like literacy and math skills.
And then what would you say? I mean, is a school that has 50% of kids sort of on grade level, a school that has 70%, a school that has 90%, what's successful?
Well, I think success is when every child is living up to their full potential. And we've seen schools that really are able to achieve those kinds of results where every student who attends that school is able to reach levels of proficiency, where every student is able to attain a college acceptance letter, where every student is able to live up to their individual dreams and aspirations. I don't think that it's worth contemplating success for anything less than every child.
Are there any examples in Kansas City in our area, or are there any examples in Missouri of schools that you would consider is succeeding in educating low-income kids?
There are some very good schools in Kansas City and Missouri. There are not schools that are sort of best in class nationally in terms of looking at the specific data when you look at the achievement results of some of the schools that we profile in our report, such as Yes Prep or University Prep in New York or It Takes a Village Academy. But there are some very good schools here. Some of the ones in Kansas City that are achieving at reasonably high levels are selective admissions schools, otherwise known as signature schools here in Kansas City. They require students to be admitted through an application process. Some of the schools require language proficiency. Some of the schools require passing an entrance exam. So for obvious reasons, those schools are not necessarily the template here. There's a role for them to play, but they can't be the only kinds of schools that a community has, because every child deserves an opportunity to attend a great school. And we've seen that even non-selective admission schools are able to succeed with every child.
Now, on Twitter, we're taking questions on Twitter at @KCRCST, and at EnoughKC asks, can any educational structure succeed with the most disadvantaged kids in the region?
I think the question is unambivalently yes. And what we have seen nationally, again, this is the frame of our entire plan, is that there are individual schools and school networks that are achieving at scale. What we don't see is a traditional urban school district succeeding at scale. And that's what led us to one of our core conclusions. There have been 26 superintendents over the past 45 years in Kansas City. There are some very, very talented people who work in the district now, who have led the district in the past, who are leading the district now, who have tried very hard to improve student achievement levels, and who have largely not been hugely successful at that. The ELA, the English language arts levels today are below that in 2010. As I said earlier, 70% of kids are below proficiency, 70%. And so our conclusion is it's not the people. There are some very talented, well-intentioned, hardworking people in the current system. We think it's not the people that's the problem. It's the system itself. And that's why we've come up with a new vision for how to create the structures for a school system that creates the conditions for all urban schools to thrive.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 FM KCUR, streaming live on kcur.org. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. We're talking about a new proposal to restructure Kansas City public schools. Later this hour, we'll look at the relevance of teaching handwriting in schools. But now we're with Ethan Gray of C Trust, who's laid out this new proposal yesterday in Jefferson City. How do you think this system of nonprofit schools, we're going to hear about it a little bit more specifically in a minute, but how do you think it will work for Kansas City? Call us at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Or email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. We also have some comments on our Facebook page that we'll get to in a minute. But first, I think we'd like to hear you lay out this plan. It's basically replacing the district schools with schools operated by nonprofits. Is that right?
Well, the basic idea is that there's an appropriate role for a central system, but it's much more limited than what the central system does today. And then there's a very important role for school-level autonomy. And the way that we've structured it is under what we call a community schools office that would function as the central school authority in the community. The role for the community school office, though, is to focus on managing performance agreements with nonprofit school operators. So the schools that are serving students well today would essentially be able to operate as they do now, except they would form a nonprofit board that would include local community leaders and parents, educators, etc., and they would have a performance agreement with the community schools office that they would achieve certain results for kids. The community schools office wouldn't make any decisions about staffing or curriculum or the culture of the school whatsoever. The educators at that school would be able to make that decision in consultation with the parents of the children who go there.
So the district office is replaced by a much diminished central office that handles some of the logistics for the whole network, but not really educational decisions.
Exactly. It provides important services like universal pre-K. In our plan, we've been able to free up $28 million of existing funds within the current system that could be better deployed to provide every single 3- and 4-year-old in Kansas City with high-quality pre-K. That we think that's a very important factor of this plan, and it's something that we heard from the focus groups that we did. It was very important to parents and educators as well, so that students can come to school prepared to learn.
Now, this community office would be run by a state-appointed executive director and appointed by the commissioner, and then the board would be appointed by the State Board of Education. That may make some people in Kansas City uneasy because they're losing local control.
Any form of state intervention is state intervention. And so the other option for state intervention is that they just replace the elected board with an appointed board called a special administrative board. That's what they've done in other regions that have been in subject to intervention, such as St. Louis or Riverview Gardens or Normandy. And what we've seen is that there have not been sustained academic gains in those contexts. The special administrative board is a form of state intervention. What we're recommending is that the commissioner appoint an executive director of the community schools office. But we also go a step further and we say, if the schools in the community improve and they're able to achieve at high levels for kids, control over the system could come back to the voters of Kansas City and the governance intervention from the state could end. So we actually call for a return to a locally elected board. We just suggest that that board has a different set of constraints under which they operate so that they would preserve the community schools office structure and not get back in the business of running schools themselves, because it's been proven they're not very good at it.
Well, let's find out a little bit more about how these nonprofit schools come to be. You mentioned that in some schools, in some cases, existing schools could then form a board, become a nonprofit. Who do you imagine would kind of lead that in the school?
I think that the teachers and the school current school principal would be very involved with that, maybe the PTA as well. I think that the process of starting a nonprofit organization is not particularly onerous, but it would be new for a lot of the people involved in this. And that's why we think that the community schools office needs to also provide some services to the community, some training and support to help parents and educators learn about how to start schools, be educated in the process, give them support to go through it.
Doesn't that take time away from teaching, though?
Well, think of it, there's got to be a transition period where you're moving from one system where we know that there's essentially guaranteed struggle and failure to a new system that's creating a different set of conditions. The educators who would be running the new school would be given autonomy in exchange for accountability, but they'd also, and this is a very important point we haven't addressed, they'd also be given control over their budgets. And with that control, under our plan, for example, educators would move from today controlling only 5% of their budget to controlling 64% of their budget tomorrow. That means that more than $10,000 per student would be under the control of the educators who are designing and leading these schools. With that money, educators could choose to do a number of important things, such as hire additional staff support, pay teachers significantly more. They could choose to extend the school day or the school year or provide wraparound services. That's another thing that we heard from our focus groups that was important to folks, was the idea of helping students come to school ready to learn by ensuring they had mental health care and access to doctors and dentists, et cetera. The point is, there's a range of decisions that schools could make about how to spend those resources. We think it's important those decisions sit at the school level.
And we did get a question from Leslie on Twitter about wraparound services, and that is a part of your plan.
It is. It's a very important part. We had focus groups with parents, with teachers, with the teachers' union, with administrators, with community-focused groups. And one of the themes from our focus groups was that there are students in Kansas City who are growing up in very difficult circumstances, many students growing up in poverty, and especially the educators feel as if it's unfair to place all of the burden on them for dealing with the effects of poverty. We know, for example, that great schools are able to achieve incredible results for students, even those growing up in poverty. But when given an opportunity like this to control more resources, schools could make a decision about whether to engage in the support of engage in providing wraparound services for kids. So in a real-life example, a school could decide to take some of that money and keep their school open until 7 o'clock at night, provide access to mental health care, partner with nonprofit community organizations to provide additional activities for students, et cetera. We're not going to prescribe what schools should do. We think schools should have the freedom to choose what best meets the needs of their students.
We have a couple of calls here, and you can call in at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888 if you have questions about the new C-Trust proposal for pretty radically changing Kansas City public schools. Dolores is calling from KCMO. Hi, Dolores.
Hello.
What's your question for our guest today?
Okay. What will be the accreditation agency for this new configuration? And will it be the same accreditation agency that currently serves traditional public schools in the state of Missouri?
I think that's interesting. And just how will they become sort of approved in general?
So our recommendation is, first of all, the community schools office is the entity that enters into performance agreements with the nonprofit school operators. So accountability sits at the community schools office level. Remember, the executive director of that office is appointed by the commissioner of the Department of Education. But in terms of accreditation, what we recommend is during the period of state intervention here, this system sits outside of the accreditation traditional accreditation process and enters into a performance agreement with the State Board of Education to ensure that there are clear metrics for how the new system is going to achieve great results. Once those high standards are met, the system would, again, as I mentioned earlier, revert to local control, to the elected, to a locally elected board that would oversee the community schools office, and then again be subject to state accreditation regulations from the Department of Education.
And you make a point of saying that these would not be charter schools, which are public schools that are accountable directly to the state and are have a charter with a local educational institution in Missouri, and then they get money directly from the state and are accountable to the state. This is different, but the idea is essentially the same, right? Because the goal is more autonomy.
This is a very important point. Let me be perfectly clear. This is not a charter school plan. And the reason for that is because in Missouri law, charter schools are considered local education agencies, or LEAs. So to your point, Sylvia, the state has an agreement with local charter school sponsors, and the sponsors authorize or sponsor charter schools. The money from the state and federal government goes directly to those schools because they are LEAs. In our plan, the community schools office is the LEA. It's a central system. It's a school system. There is still a school system in place in Kansas City or other unaccredited systems. And we think that's important because there are some central services that make the coordination of education much better and higher quality, we think. For example, citywide transportation. We think that students should be able to access any public school that best meets their needs within the community. To do that, they have to have access to a robust transportation system, or common enrollment, or universal pre-K. Ensuring that every student is able to access high-quality pre-K requires a central unit to coordinate that. So that's why we still believe in the community schools office model. The idea of giving school nonprofit school operators performance contracts borrows some autonomy ideas from the charter sector, but it expands on those by saying these schools will be better if they're part of a comprehensive system, as long as the system doesn't make it its business to try to directly operate schools or make decisions for schools when schools and the educators and parents in those schools are better positioned to make those decisions for themselves.
And what happens to existing charter schools? I mean, Kansas City is one of the places with the most charter schools. I think per capita, there's maybe 22, I think, compared to about 50 or 60 in the school district.
So the high-quality charter schools would be able to apply to the community schools office to become part of the CSO. They would be giving up their LEA status, but they would become part of the community schools office, and they would be accessing the resources, more access to per pupil revenue, access to facilities and transportation support. But the only schools that would be eligible for that are the high-performing schools. Low-performing charter schools would still be able to operate under their current sponsors. This plan doesn't address those schools, but we create a mechanism for improving the quality of charter schools over time by creating a system that would act as a magnet to try to draw the best schools into the community schools office system so that they could serve the children of the city better.
So they could continue to exist as charters, but you would hope that they would join the system.
Only the good ones, yes.
As to that, I mean, how will this central office find enough operators to replace all of the district schools? And I ask that partly because, you know, the charter schools, as you point out in Kansas City, most of them are doing no better than the district schools. And so, you know, operators have come in, they've tried to open schools, but they haven't necessarily been successful.
Right. And that's a very good question. And one of the core focuses of the community schools office has got to be on building the supply of high-quality school operators, and that means working very intentionally with educators and school leaders to help them prepare the most effective ones to help them prepare to open new schools. It means recruiting to the community high-quality school operators from outside, for example, local surrounding districts that are achieving good results for low-income children would be eligible to apply. High-performing national school nonprofit school operators would be eligible to apply. The question is, how can the system create the kinds of conditions that school operators and educators would find most compelling? We think the way to do that is to give them control over far more money, to give them autonomy, and to treat educators like the professionals that they are by allowing them to make the decisions that best meet the needs of their children.
Now, I have to ask, there are a lot of questions in Kansas City about your organization and its support for privatization of schools. Do you see for-profit operators eligible as operators of these nonprofit schools?
Absolutely not. We are very clear on that in our plan. We explicitly outlaw or would recommend outlawing for-profit operators from operating within the system. And I want to be very clear on this point. We do not believe in privatization. That is a term that gets thrown around without much understanding about what it really means. We believe in public education. We believe that every child deserves access to a great public school. And we think that the definition of public school is one in which students are able to access that school without having to jump through hoops, where the schools are held accountable by a public agency, where parents have the option to choose the best public school for their child. And so we are very clear on this point. This is not a privatization plan. This is about creating a different kind of public school system.
There is a question from Angie on Facebook who asked, how many nonprofit organizations would you expect even just one school to have to go through before the dust finally settles and they get it right? We just sent the entire district into chaos 2 years ago at the start of the current RSIP plan, which is a state plan that is trying to meet the state accountability requirements. So what Angie asked, why would we want to interrupt the current plan to do it again?
There are a number of different questions in that. I think if you are a student of history and you look at the historical performance trends and the current performance trends, the academic trends are not are troubling. And I think you have to face the numbers here when you've got 70% of students who are below proficiency, and where the district has made the most progress recently is an area where the state has made similar progress. So especially in science, for example, where you see a significant gain in student achievement levels in science in the district, that same gain has been made by students statewide. So the gap has not gotten smaller demonstrably. That there's important nuance to that kind of level of analysis around student achievement results. Our view is that the folks in Kansas City have been through a lot. We recognize that. We recognize that there's some sort of quote-unquote reform fatigue. But again, we have to look at this as researchers and as students of history. There have been 26 superintendents in 45 years. The current model is not stable. It is not serving students well. It is not allowing students to achieve at high results. And ultimately, we don't think it's a sustainable structure to provide the kind of opportunities that educators and parents and students deserve for school excellence.
We have a question here from Gretchen in KCMO. Hi, Gretchen.
Hi. I have a couple questions based on my...
You know what, Gretchen? We're having some echo on your line. I'm just going to put you on hold and try and bring you back in a minute.
Okay.
And let's try Jane here in KCMO. Hi, Jane.
Hi. I attended the C-Trust presentation in Jefferson City yesterday, and as a result of hearing the presentation, I have a couple of questions. One is regarding the issue of choice for schools. We have that in Kansas City with our desegregation plan at magnet schools. A lot of trouble, one revolving around transportation costs, and the other is that if there are not an adequate number of really high-performing schools, then not all students really have choice there. So how does this plan differ in offering choice in a short amount of time from what we had with magnet schools?
Jane, thank you very much for your question. Thanks so much for coming to Jefferson City. I know that's a long drive, and we appreciated that so many folks came out yesterday to attend the state board meeting. Great question about choice and the supply of operators. So first of all, magnet schools are selective admission schools. Students have to apply to get into them. They have to meet certain academic benchmarks. They have to speak, you know, a second language or something like that. There's a
Kansas City magnet program.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that. Say again, please.
That was not actually true with the Kansas City Magnet Program. Only a handful of schools had admission standards. The others were all open admission.
Jaden was talking about previously in previous reform efforts with the whole DSEG plan.
Yep. And your other point, Jane, is spot on, which is what good is choice if you don't have a sufficient supply of high-quality operators? That's why we've designed a transition period and suggested that a big focus of the community schools office early on has got to be on empowering educators and school leaders, providing them with support on how to design and open new schools to immediately try to recruit the best possible nonprofit operators that they can, and to focus on ensuring a sufficient supply of schools. It's going to take some time to get every school to be high quality, but we think that it's worth the investment of time, and we think that very early on there's going to be a significant number of new schools and newly freed up schools that we'll be able to achieve at higher levels. One last point on this is that there's a research has come out of Stanford University about the charter school sector that has shown that when a charter school first starts, if it's achieving good results, it's likely to continue to achieve good results. However, on the flip side, if it does not achieve good results early on, it is unlikely to ever achieve good results. That suggests there's a very strong emphasis that needs to be put on ensuring that schools are successful right out of the gate, which is why we think that needs to be a big area of focus for the community schools office.
We have a question. Oh, we have Gretchen back. Hi, Gretchen.
Hi. I am calling. I am not opposed to this in theory. However, I have two questions based on an in-fact local not school run by a not-for-profit. The first question is, he said that there would be far greater budget that the school administrators would be in control of. And so my question is, what, if any, requirement would there be of the ratio that, of the expenditures of the budget that has to go directly towards educating kids and the programs as opposed to teacher salaries? The school I'm aware of, it is an obnoxious amount of the budget goes towards salaries versus providing services to the kids. The other question is regarding accountability. With the school I'm aware of, in order for a parent to challenge a child's, a special needs child's IEP, there is a whole nother layer of hoops that you have to jump through as opposed to if your child is in a public school. And so my question is, you know, with the accountability, if the same structure that the state regulations provide now is kept in place for parents to get involved and, you know, challenge problems, that just seems not to be feasible.
Well, thanks, Gretchen. That's two questions there, Ethan.
Yeah, let me tackle the second one first. So special education is a very important area, and we think that it's an area where all schools have an obligation to serve all of the children who want to attend that school. And so special education obligations would persist, and the community schools office would provide support for special education services. So we would not want to create a system that required parents to jump through more hoops to advocate for their kids. In fact, we think that by ensuring that more decision-making can happen at the school level, as well as ensuring that schools have an obligation to serve every child, including those with special needs, that we can ensure that students on IEPs or with special education needs have their requirements met and are able to be responsive. Those schools are able to be responsive to parents. But let me just address the first question that Gretchen raised about how the budget is controlled and who makes decisions about how much teachers should be paid. My flip question to Gretchen would be, well, how is that school achieving? And if it's achieving great results, then I think that we take a hands-off approach. If a school, for example, wants to pay teachers $100,000 a year and they're able to be very successful at helping students achieve at high levels, but they don't provide as many after-school programs or wraparound services, at the end of the day, what we care about is results for kids. We don't think it's the system's role to dictate what programs, what salary schedules, what calendars, what curriculum schools should use. We want to give schools and educators in those schools and the parents of the students in those schools the ability to make those kinds of decisions. And we think the nonprofit structure that we're advocating here puts power much more into the hands of educators and parents so they can make those types of decisions.
Now, let me ask about teachers. You wrote the plan that teachers would be allowed to collectively bargain, but
yes.
That doesn't mean unions or the existing AFT here in Kansas City, right?
Sure it does. It absolutely. So what we're suggesting is that the unit that they would be organizing would not be at the district, that they would not have one contract to govern every single school within the system. We think that bargaining should happen at the school level. And the reason why we think that is because some educators might want to have a Montessori school. Some might want to have a science and technology school. Some might want to have a wraparound services themed school. We think that all of those types of schools should exist and that teachers' unions should be free to organize those schools, and teachers at those schools should be free to collectively bargain with whatever union they think best meets their needs. One of the schools that we talk about in our report is a charter school in New York City called University Prep that has been organized by the American Federation of Teachers, which is the same union that governs the Kansas City Federation of Teachers. That's an example of site-based contracting, and that's, I think, a model that is a very important point. We are not suggesting anything that would restrict teachers' ability to collectively bargain. We're just suggesting it should happen at the school level.
So the schools wouldn't be required to hire unionized teachers?
Well, when the state intervenes, it has the ability to lapse a district, and that makes basically all existing contracts go away, and you have to start over from there. So, in any form, my understanding is that in any form of state intervention, that is a possibility. What we're suggesting is, if that were the case, that really there would be no. The community schools office would not be the employer of teachers. The schools themselves would be the employer, and unions need to negotiate with the employer.
We have a call here from Robert in Midtown. Hi, Robert.
Hello. My question would like to address your program's if your proposal has addressed the services and equipment, supplies, and all those things that now central system can provide when it comes to economic of scale. You're talking about entities, or how does that affect? Because that could be costly for any one school to handle.
That's a very good question.
We're talking about benefits. We're talking about all those things that now economic of scale support that.
Yep, that's a very important question, and a good one that was raised yesterday as well. We think that there are certainly areas where economies of scale make sense. We don't expect that every school will be a standalone nonprofit. We expect that many schools will choose to become networks and to achieve economies of scale by opting into networks. We don't want to dictate that, because some schools may choose to contract with one set of providers and another school may choose to contract with a different set. Again, the theme here is the decision-making power goes to the school level. And obviously, if I were the leader of a school, I'd be looking for economies of scale. And so I might opt to join a network of other nonprofit high-quality school operators for the provision of some back-office services. I do want to emphasize, though, that's an issue about adults and an important one. But we want to stay focused on the conditions that are required to allow those adults to be successful with kids. And that's why we keep coming back to these core conditions of ensuring that educators run schools and that schools are held accountable.
Question from Steve in Brookside.
Hi there. My question has to do, or it's a two-part question. What authority does the school principal have to deal with bad teachers and bad kids? And what I mean by that is, if there's an incompetent teacher, does he have the authority to terminate that teacher? And how does the union get involved with that? And the second part of that is, I call them bad kids. And some people are going to not like the word bad, but a few years ago in Southwest, there were a lot of troublemakers came over when they reorganized the school, and they had to get those kids out of there. And it took them to some alternative school or something like that. In the case of your plan, the kids that are troublemakers, can the principal exclude them, and then what happens to those kids?
Thank you for your question. Both are good questions. So first of all, the decision about what happens with the teachers depends on the individual school and what its collective bargaining situation is. But the principle of our plan is to give educators control over staffing, so that the principals, the leaders of those schools, can hire and fire the education teams that they want. If that school becomes collectively bargained or unionized, then they'll have their own contract that governs how that works. And I think that's just as it should be, that educators should be able to do that at the school level. But the principle is that when, you know, in our plan is that we give schools the autonomy to decide the HR practices that best meet their needs. When it comes to dealing with students who have disciplinary problems, we think it's very important that there's a common expulsion policy that all schools have to observe, because what we can't have happen is one school decide, well, we're not going to serve these students who are difficult to educate or who have struggles in one way or another. One of the reasons why we put extra money into the budget here is to give schools the ability to purchase kind of wraparound services and support services that can help students like that. We want to ensure that the system serves all kids, so we create a common expulsion policy that ensures that if a student is expelled from a kid, from a school, they're going to find an option within the system somewhere else.
Now, you know, I have to ask, a lot of people in Kansas City are thinking, people have been clamoring for stability in this district. And, you know, Andrew asked on Facebook, it's a time when the Kansas City community is ready to get involved and help schools can succeed. So, you know, after a long history of court-ordered desegregation and the district operating under a special master, now that we finally have a stable board and superintendent and are seeing a little progress, and I hear what you're saying is that progress would take a long time to really pay off towards success. But how do you convince people here in Kansas City to experiment with something that hasn't been tried anywhere else when we do see that stability finally?
Well, I think it's important to clear up a misconception here. This is not, in some respects, an experimentation of something that hasn't been tried. The principles of this plan are based on the kind of results that the best schools in the country are able to achieve. I think the community members and parents in Kansas City deserve to have world-class schools. And if we can design a system that creates the conditions through which those schools could emerge here, I think that is an incredible and important opportunity. I also think that stability, the notion that the system has stabilized, is a bit misleading. When you've stabilized a system in which 70% of children are not proficient at English language arts or math, where the average ACT score is 16.1, that's a real – you've stabilized something that is not serving kids well. I think there's an opportunity here to explore a different kind of system and one that would create the conditions through which all schools could succeed.
Ethan Gray is executive director at Cities for Education Entrepreneurship Trust, or C-Trust, which has also authored this proposal on how to transform Kansas City public schools that he just presented in Jefferson City to the State Board of Education. Thank you, Ethan Gray, so much for joining us on Central Standard.
Thank you so much for having me.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we talk about the role of handwriting in today's elementary schools. Join that conversation by calling in now during the break, 816-235-2888. Central Standard will return in just a moment. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross. The Kansas Board of Education recently reaffirmed the teaching of cursive in Kansas schools. So we thought we'd check in on how handwriting in general is being taught in this day and age. Joining us to discuss how and why we educate kids in handwriting and cursive is Professor Kendall Turner-Nash. She's an assistant professor of urban teacher education, reading and literacy at UMKC. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Wonder, Professor Nash, how has the teaching of handwriting changed in recent years?
Well, I think one of the major things that I found as I was reviewing the literature about handwriting is that it's not being taught as explicitly as maybe it used to be. And so, you know, when I was a child, we had handwriting for about an hour, math for about an hour, reading for about an hour. And that's just not happening in this age of testing and emphasis on testing. So,
and is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, as I reviewed the literature on handwriting, I see that it's not a good thing because handwriting is actually linked to the development of writing. So kids become better writers by practicing their handwriting every day.
You're not just talking about better writers as in the writing looks better, but content-wise.
Yes, they become better composers. I read several studies that showed that children that actively practice the skill of handwriting in kindergarten and in preschool, in third grade, they can compose more complex texts. So there's links to actually practicing the skill of formation of those letters and later on composition.
Hmm. Now, asking our audience, is handwriting or cursive still a necessary skill? Join the conversation at 816-235-2888, or you can email us at centralstandard@kcur.org. You could also tweet us a picture of your finest handwritten comment or question to prove your point at KCURCST. What grades do teachers usually teach handwriting, and when do they stop teaching it in favor of, you know, the more content subjects?
Well, traditionally, handwriting instruction begins in kindergarten, and there are several models of handwriting instruction that are actively being used in schools. There are actually three models, one of the leading researchers on handwriting development, her name is Virginia Berninger. She talks about how handwriting really needs to be taught at the preschool level these days because of the demands of the Common Core standards and raising the bar on what we expect of students.
Interesting. Do the kids have the motor skills to learn how to form letters at that age?
Well, handwriting, just like speech and just like writing and just like reading, progresses through fluid stages as you become a better skilled at handwriting, you progress through natural stages. And those stages do start in preschool with pre-writing kinds of skills.
Now, computers must take a lot of time away from handwriting. You know, starting at kindergarten and earlier, there are computers in the classroom, in some cases computers for every child. How do you see that trade-off?
Well, the research is really clear that computers and keyboarding does not and should not replace traditional handwriting instruction, whether it's in manuscript or whether it's in cursive. What the research says is that either manuscript or cursive is fine as long as handwriting is being taught as part of the entire literacy curriculum, but that keyboarding can't replace handwriting instruction because what's happening when you're forming those letters, it's called the orthographic loop. In your mind, the child is picturing in their mind the letter, and then they're using their hand to write that letter on the page with a pencil. That's called the orthographic loop, and it's a very important process that needs to happen that just can't happen if you're keying a letter on a keyboard.
Interesting. So that there, at one point, there's going to be something that kids are missing in their literacy skills if they're just learning, like, an A is this key on the keyboard.
Right, because, again, you know, as students are coming to understand their letters, there are two things that are happening. They're understanding the way the letter looks, and they're understanding the way the letter sounds. And it's very important for their hand, for that motor skill of writing the letter, in order for that cognitive processing to happen between connecting the letter sound and the way the letter looks.
Now, what about cursive specifically?
Right. You know, it's very interesting because my children attend a school in Kansas City, and they are required to write in cursive. And we actually came from a military family. We lived all over the world, and they had sort of scattered cursive instruction. And now they're required to write in cursive, and it's been challenging a little bit. So I was curious to read what the research said about cursive. Is it better than manuscript or what? And really what it says is that there's no difference. Everything that I read says that it doesn't matter whether you teach cursive or whether you teach manuscript.
Now we have Jean on the line who may disagree. Hi, Jean.
Hi.
What do you think about cursive?
Well, I have an interesting story. My mother, who is my granddaughter's great-grandmother, my granddaughter, when I was talking to her on the phone, said, I love getting letters from Nana, but I don't know how to read them because it's in cursive. She's 10 years old and lives in Florida. That, to me, is sad.
What do you think is the advantage of cursive versus just any kind of handwriting, Jean?
Well, my concern is years from now, children finding letters from relatives, or if they want to be involved in anthropology or learn about human beings, civilization. I just think that's sad if some of them are without those skills, don't know really everything there is to know about cursive. Not only the fact that it's fun, I thought it was really fun to learn cursive writing when I was in school, and I ended up being involved in the arts, and part of it was because that kind of got me started. It was fun. You worked with a pen or a pencil. The circles you make, it was just fun.
Well, Professor Nash, but you don't find that there's necessarily an academic benefit to cursive versus handwriting in general.
No, not necessarily. There haven't been any studies that I've read that indicate that cursive is more advantageous than manuscript. Just again, that the teaching of handwriting has to be an overall part of the literacy curriculum. That's what's most important. But I do hear what Jean is saying, that it's, you know, it's sort of becoming a lost art.
And are there kids who struggle more with than others with mastering cursive or just handwriting in general?
Yes, I read an interesting study. Like I mentioned earlier, there are three ways that handwriting is typically taught in schools. I'm sure we all remember the little stick and arrows. Remember the little circles, and it had arrows telling you how to form the circle and which way to draw the line. Do you remember that?
Vaguely. I just remember the sheets with the dotted lines across them.
Right, right. And so there's one program. It's called Danielian, and it's supposed to ease children from manuscript to cursive writing. So the letters are sort of slanted, and what I read was that form of writing is actually more difficult for children to master than some other of the forms. There's another one called Zanner Blosser. I remember the workbooks that I used to use when I was teaching first grade were Zanner Blosser workbooks, and that those are more effective than this Danielian sort of cursive. But then on the other hand, like I said before, my children attend the Montessori school, and they're required to write in cursive, and it's been extremely advantageous for my son, who's left-handed and who had horrible handwriting before he started.
Cursive made it easier.
Cursive made it easier for him.
Interesting. Yeah. Now, what do you think teachers today, the teachers that you're training, I mean, what do they feel about handwriting in cursive?
Well, it always comes up in my early literacy methods classes, whether or not we should focus on handwriting versus typing, and whether or not we should focus on cursive versus print. But for me, the stance that I take in my classes is a balanced approach to literacy. So I am always saying, yes, you should focus on digital literacies, but you should also focus on handwriting. And if cursive, you know, is required in the school district, then cursive is a form of handwriting. It's clear that doesn't matter what kind of handwriting you focus on.
Do you assign to your adult students handwritten assignments, or is everything for you typed up?
Most of it is typed up for me.
How do teachers learn to have that beautiful teacher handwriting?
Well, we do use a lot of charts in our work with children. My classes typically meet at a school, and they are working hands-on with children. So they do lots of writing with the children there. But you're right, that perfect first grade teacher handwriting that I always admired maybe becoming a lost art.
And do you still enjoy writing in handwriting cursive and all of that? Or are you, like many of us, are your handwriting skills kind of declining?
My handwriting skills are so declining. Yeah, it hurts my hand to write for more than an hour.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. Kendall Turner Nash is Assistant Professor of Urban Teacher Education, Reading and Literacy at UMKC. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for Central Standard today. You can subscribe to our podcast, hear this conversation again, or access any of our previous shows from the Central Standard page of kcur.org. Tune in tomorrow as we look at how the government has influenced how we eat over the years. Up to Date is next with a conversation with Kansas author William Least Heat Moon. Our show was produced by Matthew Long Middleton. I'm Sylvia Maria Gross, and this is KCUR.